This episode of She Explores is sponsored by Subaru and the 2018 Subaru Crosstrek. Stay tuned for later in the episode, when we take one for a test drive with Olympic runner and artist Sarah Attar. Love is out there. Find it in a Crosstrek. Learn more at Subaru.com/Crosstrek.
I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
So, there's things I have in common with Randy, and I think that might be really disturbing for people to hear because he stabbed Tomomi 29 times. You know, he's a violent criminal, but part of what I tried to communicate in this book is we're all connected in ways, and just because someone is a criminal, it doesn't mean that we may not have things in common with them, because it's not that black and white, the differences between people.
This is Annette McGivney, author of the book Pure Land. When she says she has something in common with a murderer, she's right. And she also has something in common with a tourist from Japan, as well as the American landscape. I love the book because Annette doesn't hold anything back. At her core, she's a journalist. She investigates her own story like she investigates that of the subjects in the book. As a reader, I was entranced by how each person came alive through her diligent research, resulting in a tribute to a curious woman named Tomomi and a reunion with Annette's childhood self. Please note that this episode contains discussion of childhood trauma, which may be sensitive for some listeners. Also, if you haven't read Pure Land, but you're planning to, this interview is a bit revealing towards the plot, but there is so much more to be found within its pages. Okay, let's meet Annette.
Pure Land started when I covered a story for Backpacker Magazine in 2007. It was about a murder investigation of a woman named Tomomi Hanamura, and she was murdered in Grand Canyon near Havasu Falls on the Havasupai Reservation in May of 2006. And she was killed by an 18-year-old Havasupai tribal member named Randy West Kagami, and he had a very troubled life up to that point. And so the story I wrote for Backpacker didn't really get to dig into the circumstances of their lives. It just looked at the murder itself. And so Pure Land was my quest to better understand the murder and how it happened and to dig into their lives. And what happened was, as I looked deeper into what had happened to them in their childhoods and as adults, it brought up a lot of stuff for me. And so I began exploring my own history. What we had in common was childhood traumas. And for Randy and me, we both had in common violence in our childhoods that we experienced. And so the story is about a murder, but it's also about family violence and about how connection to wild places can help heal trauma.
You know, in reading it, for me, it's also about the trauma that can kind of be embedded in landscape. What might people who visit Havasu and the Grand Canyon be surprised by within its history?
That's a great point about how trauma is being embedded in the land, because when we think of Grand Canyon and the natural wonder that it is, we think about the geology and the panoramas and the beautiful experience of being in something so spectacular. But the thing is that Grand Canyon, like everywhere in the United States, is the indigenous home of Native people. And it was the indigenous home of the Havasupai tribe up until Europeans came and started settling the Western United States. The Havasupai people had all of Grand Canyon, as well as the Coconino Plateau on the south rim of Grand Canyon, as their home, and they lived there. And that's how they survived, by not only living in Grand Canyon, but on the plateau to hunt. So that was something like 2 million acres. and they were forced onto a reservation that was only 500 acres at the bottom of Grand Canyon when European immigrants came in and wanted to begin mining in Grand Canyon and hunting and grazing on the Coconino Plateau. That was in the late 1800s. And so there was a lot of trauma that started then for the Havasupai people and also other indigenous tribes in the area that called Grand Canyon home or part of their home, the Hopi, the Navajo, the Paiute, the Hualapai. Losing Grand Canyon for these people was very traumatic, not only in a spiritual level because they were tied to the place as part of their spiritual traditions, but also on a pure sustenance level, like their ability to feed themselves was taken away. For them, what we see is what Ken Burns said, America's greatest idea. Yeah, national parks are a great idea, but the truth is those parks were someone else's before we claimed them, you know, as our crown jewels. And so there's a lot of trauma for Native peoples around the national park system. So when people go to see Havasu Falls on the Havasupai Reservation or hike anywhere in Grand Canyon, they're in someone's homeland and it was stolen. So that's kind of the dark side of our national parks.
Yeah, and the other piece that's hard to reconcile, especially for me when I was reading your book, it's tough to see the years in which this happened. In the grand scheme of things, and even the history of the United States, it wasn't that long ago.
Right, it wasn't that long ago. You know, just 150, 100 years ago, for the Havasupai, they, you know, almost starved to death from not being supported in any way by the federal government and having their home taken away from them. As, you know, recent as like 1920, they were nearly starving. And even as recently as the 1970s, the Havasupai had their Havasu Falls area managed by the National Park Service. They wanted to get those falls back under management of the tribe because those are sacred places to the tribe. And when they were lobbying the federal government to get their sacred falls returned to them, environmental groups like the Sierra Club fought them in like congressional hearings saying that the Havasupai tribe wouldn't be a good environmental stewards of the land. And that was in the 1970s. There's a lot of negative feelings that the tribe has against the federal government and the Park Service in particular over all those years and decades of trauma.
Mm. Yeah, in a lot of ways, it sounded like the Havasupai are also dependent on tourists in order to have a livelihood, and that makes for a complicated relationship too.
So this place that was stolen from them, it was given back to them on the condition that they leave it open to tourism. So it is a really bittersweet arrangement that they have.
One of these tourists was named Tomomi, and she was killed by Randy, an 18-year-old Havasupai tribal member, on her 34th birthday. Tomomi loved the American West and visited frequently on road trips.
As a Japanese woman who was drawn to the American West, as a child, she didn't have any connection to the United States, but she was somehow drawn to our massive landscapes where there's wide open space and these very iconic landmarks like the Grand Canyon and Badlands and Yosemite and Yellowstone. And she put these pictures of these places on her wall in her bedroom when she was a child. And so as an adult, that was her dream, was to come to our crown jewels and experience them. But alternately, she was also really drawn to the story of Native Americans. I guess as Americans, we're just so used to living in the United States and kind of taking a lot of our history for granted, especially as citizens of the United States, we maybe pay more attention to some parts of our history than others, and that becomes the dominant narrative. And so I wanted to show how Tomomi experienced the American West through fresh eyes. She experienced the landscape in a way that I felt really touched me as a journalist because I could see in looking at her journal entries, you know, how she didn't just see Native American culture as sort of something on the side. She saw it as something that was really integral to the places that she visited in the way that she tried to explore the history, not only of the land, but of the people. And that struck me as, we don't do that often as tourists in our own country. And at least that was my interpretation. And so I wanted to show her experience in these national parks and other wild places in the West and her desire to learn more. And then I wanted to create another layer behind that to really take the reader on a walk through the American West, like during the time when Native peoples in these regions were having their homelands taken from them, so that the reader would not only experience what Tomomi did when she was driving through Yellowstone in the Badlands, but also to take the reader through what it was like in those areas when Native people were losing their home, and to reinforce kind of our own history in this land, both now and in the past, in terms of how we acquired these crown jewels.
Hmm. What personally drew you to Arizona as a place to make your home?
And Tomomi and I had a lot of things in common, even though, you know, she was from Japan and I was from Texas. I grew up in East Texas, which is a rural area, and I roamed the woods. I loved nature as a child. Sometimes I would climb up on the roof or climb up onto the top of my treehouse to try and see where the sun was setting. I had this desire to see like the horizon in big, wide open spaces. And so when I was a teenager, my family went out to West Texas and there were no trees and you could see forever. And I thought, wow, this is my place. And I just became drawn to big, wide open spaces. Also, I increasingly became interested in backpacking. Fortunately, 25 years ago, I got a job as an editor with Backpacker Magazine, and that took me into the West. And I visited Arizona on a trip for Backpacker and actually came to Flagstaff, where I live now. And when I came, I thought, this is where I want to live. Like, it's got mountains, it's got canyons, it's close to the Grand Canyon. Like, this is my place. And so I was able to swing it so that I did end up being able to move here. And I just love the Southwest. I love the slick rock and the colors and the sunsets and the Grand Canyon especially. So I just feel like I'm a person of wide open spaces.
There's a lot of a feeling of freedom in that. You mentioned a kinship with Tomomi while you were researching the book and before you had your own more personal revelations about your childhood. Did you feel any kinship with Randy when you were researching?
Well, I did. At first, I didn't realize it. My subconscious connection with him actually triggered flashbacks to my own violent childhood. When I was originally digging in to this story and wanting to learn more about Tomomi and wanting to learn more about Randy, I mean, I could understand my connection to Tomomi, and that didn't surprise me at all. She and I were both women who loved the Grand Canyon. We hiked alone and loved it. Randy seemed like he was from a totally different world and a totally different upbringing from me. My father was a doctor. We were well off financially. All my basic survival needs were met, no problem, unlike Randy's childhood. But I was given reports from Randy's father about, you know, what Randy experienced as a child. And I saw how he was violently beaten by his father and his mother, and how he was acting out in school and reacting to that kind of violence in a negative way. And what I knew deep down was that I had also been a victim of family violence. My father beat me also, and it also impacted me as a child. Like, Randy had learning disabilities. I did too as a kid. Randy got in fights in school. So did I. And so deep down, I knew all these things and I tried to kind of shove them aside. But the more I looked into Randy and his behavior as a child, it was not that different than mine. And so, I mean, obviously he acted out in a more violent way than I did, but early childhood, you know, we were kind of had some similarities, and I came to subconsciously realize that. And that actually caused me to start having flashbacks of things I experienced as a kid. And that was terrifying. So yeah, there's things I have in common with Randy. And I think that might be really disturbing for people to hear, because he stabbed Tomomi 29 times. You know, he's a violent criminal. But part of what I tried to communicate in this book is we're all connected in ways. And just because someone is a criminal, it doesn't mean that we may not have things in common with them, because it's not that black and white, the differences between people.
Yeah, and there are different ways that people manifest trauma.
That's right. Yeah. And so for me, the way I handled my childhood trauma was to just shove it down deeper and deeper into my subconscious and try and, you know, not think about it and keep it under wraps. But there's this thing that I say in the book, a term Freud, the psychoanalyst, coined, and repetition compulsion, and which is a description for a behavior where you've got something that happened to you, some type of trauma, and you're trying to ignore it, to dissociate it, yet your subconscious wants you to deal with it and resolve it so that you can kind of move on. And so if you've got some type of, you know, trauma or history in your past that you don't want to deal with, you can act out and try and creep closer and closer to the thing that you're trying to avoid, because subconsciously you're trying to get yourself to that place so you can work through it. And so part of the reason why I was drawn to this story and telling Randy's story as well as Tomomi's was I was not only trying to figure out the violence in Randy's past that influenced his behavior, but I was trying to figure out the violence in my own past.
We learn more about Annette after a word from our sponsor, Subaru.
This episode of She Explores is sponsored by Subaru and their 2018 Subaru Crosstrek. We talked to Sarah Attar, professional runner and artist, about her experience after a test drive. Sarah had ideas about what she would load up in the hatch and where she would go.
Well, because I've been like getting out into the mountains a bit more and doing more camping in the Eastern Sierra lately, and just did this weekend trip to Lone Pine. So it's really fun to picture, you have your bag, your sleeping bag, your tent, and then your like camping box, and it all just kind of fits in there. It curates these projects and trips you have in mind, which is really fun.
Where would you take the Crosstrek?
Ooh, oh man. There are like endless dirt roads in the Eastern Sierra that if you can drive to them, they are access points for so many points in the mountains. So that's the ideal to get me to trailheads that might be farther out. There's like something cool about being able to get there on foot, but then also to get there in a car to get farther out. It gives you more access.
Love is out there. Find it in a Crosstrek. Learn more at Subaru.com/Crosstrek.
We're back.
Can you describe a little bit about what dissociation is for anyone who's not familiar with that term that you typically just read about in textbooks if you're a psychology student?
Right. So as a journalist, I was diagnosed as someone with dissociative amnesia by the psychiatrist. I had to research this on my own to try and understand it because I couldn't believe that it was true. And this happens a lot with children that are in a traumatic or violent environment, or they're experiencing some type of abuse. when you, as a human, are undergoing something that's really terrible, and then you don't have some type of experience after that traumatic event to help you work through what happened and kind of incorporate it into your consciousness and saying, well, that was really horrible, but I'm okay, and now I can go on. And if you experience something, especially as a child, that's really traumatic and no one around acknowledges it or helps you work through it, and in my case, like, you know, I was beaten and then no one ever talked about it, everyone just pretended like it didn't happen. You just think, well, I guess it didn't happen, and you dissociate those memories from your conscious mind and put them in this little secret box. You can develop a pattern over time of dissociation where that just becomes your habit, as it did for me, where every time I would be beaten by my father, I would just dissociate and essentially split myself into two people. So there was the little kid that was being beaten, and then there was the other part of me that was like the normal kid that went to school and had parents that loved her. And so that little kid that was beaten was sort of this dissociated part of my psyche that I had not come to terms with until she exploded onto the scene in a really crazy way through flashbacks. Mm-hmm. And so dissociation it's a coping mechanism. It's not healthy, but that's what happens to the mind. Has to find a way to continue on. And so when bad things happen, that's sometimes what the mind does, is it just carves off the bad stuff and puts it in a box, but it continues to live in your mind.
Yeah, and express itself in different ways in your life.
That's right. And so people that may have dissociated also, you know, from traumatic events, I think there's statistics that show that's a big reason around substance abuse. When those memories are kind of trying to get out of that box, people just drink more, or they do drugs, or they engage in other compulsive behaviors to try and not let those memories that were dissociated come out.
And it must feel like a nightmare to be in your late 40s and experiencing and kind of meeting this childhood side of yourself for the first time.
It was terrifying because as a child, you know, I had been convinced that if I were to say anything to anyone about what had happened to me, that not only would it tear apart my family, but for some reason, I thought I would die. Like I thought I would, like I wouldn't be able to survive it. And I also felt like, you know, that part of me there was so much shame around it, you know. And that's a sad thing about kids that experience trauma, is they have so much shame around it. And it's not their shame; it's their parents' shame, the people that were traumatizing them. But you know, they have all this shame, and so. It was really hard to believe that these memories were coming back so late in life. And the more I started to acknowledge that they existed, the more they kept coming and in more detail. And so it was like my whole childhood kind of came alive in a way that I had never allowed myself to acknowledge as an adult. And also my whole MO as an adult up to that point was that I was super tough. I was so strong. I was like, I could handle anything. And so I had this belief that my willpower was what had gotten me through as a child, and that my willpower could handle anything as an adult. And I was completely flattened by these flashbacks. Like my willpower and my strength was nothing compared to the intensity of what I was experiencing. And so that really broke me in terms of, or at least sort of my facade.
What were some of the ways that you took care of yourself? I know you went to traditional therapy, but you also used nature as therapy.
I guess as a child, the only thing I knew how to do to make myself feel better in my home, where my mother had chronic depression, and so she was in bed a lot of the time, and she was just And she never intervened with the violent episodes with my father. And so my house was not a safe place. The community in which I lived, because no one knew what I was experiencing, there was no support there. And so as a child, I was just really comforted by the woods around my house and wandering in the woods. And I found such great comfort in nature. And that was probably like the single most important connection for me as a child, was to like the trees and to the ground. Like I was just so comforted by all the surroundings in these wild places. And so as I got, you know, into my teenage years and I started trying to become like an adult without any real good role models on what a functional adult looks like, I started to think of the kind of the way I wandered in the woods as kind of being a childlike behavior, and that I needed to grow out of it and get serious. But I still loved the outdoors. So I turned my childlike connection to nature into like this backpacking powerhouse, you know, where I was just writing stories. I was hiking trails and an editor for Backpacker Magazine and getting to the top of the mountain and then writing about it. And I feel like I had turned sort of that childlike connection to nature into this more work-oriented, goal-oriented relationship that kind of takes the magic out of it. And so when I was really just devastated by these flashbacks, I found myself walking in the woods again, and all that adult facade I had built up around willpower and goal-oriented, you know, person fell away, and that childhood connection to nature came back. And so that's the biggest way I've taken care of myself, and I continue every day to just go hiking like 4 or 5 miles a day. I live in an area, fortunately, where I can do that. And I do bigger trips, backpacking trips in Grand Canyon. But now it's the trauma, PTSD, and kind of the therapy I've had to come up with myself for kind of what works for me is being in nature every day. Like, it's not like once a week. It's like if I'm not out in the woods for at least an hour a day, I'm sort of off center, like I'm not grounded. And so I was so shaken by the trauma and the flashbacks that it really took away what I thought I needed to do as an adult, which was, you know, just to do everything through my ego or my willpower. And it plugged me back into this greater, like my true self. And so every day, if I don't spend enough time in nature, especially like wild nature, I'm not plugged into my true self. And I feel like I'm prone to kind of gravitating away from that and getting enmeshed in, you know, all the busyness of life. And so every day I try and plug back into that true part of me, which is totally and completely connected to the natural world.
And would you say that true part of you is also connected to that childhood self, so that you're more whole and less fractured?
Yes, yes, that is a great, you could be a psychiatrist, oh. Yes. Yes, that is totally true. And that is what it's all about with childhood trauma. When an adult is trying to work through childhood trauma, it's about bringing that little kid back under the roof, you know, and saying it's okay. And I went through the Adult Children of Alcoholics program. It's a 12-step program, and they call it reparenting. So there's like this part of yourself, this kid that didn't get to be parented, you know, in a functional way. And so you got to bring that kid back. It's totally bringing that part of me back into myself and, you know, making me more whole. And that is like your mind could be continued to be fractured in some ways, like because your brain was formed in trauma when you're a kid, but your soul self is complete and whole in nature, is the way I feel. And so I feel like completely joyful and whole in the natural world more than anywhere else. And so that's right. Yeah, it's for me, that's why being in wild places is the best medicine for people that have experienced trauma.
And that brings it back to that concept of pure land too, right? The Japanese concept that you describe in the book?
Right. So the title of the book, Pure Land, it means a couple of different things. Most literally, it is a sect of Buddhism in Japan called Pure Land Buddhism. And that form of Buddhism came into popularity as a kind of the peasant sect of Buddhism. Like Zen Buddhism was great for the monks because they had all this time. But the working class, the farmers in Japan in the 13 and 1400s, they had to be in the fields all the time. So they didn't have time to meditate. So they would pray as they worked, and they would pray this prayer, which was to be taken to the Pure Land, which was a Western land of peace and bliss after they died. And so that was sort of their version of heaven, was the Pure Land. And that's what Pure Land Buddhism is about. And so Pure Land for Tomomi was essentially heaven, you know, and I feel like she found her version of heaven in the West, and maybe even Grand Canyon specifically. And so maybe she wound up in her version of heaven, in her version of the Pure Land in Grand Canyon. And for me, I have also found my version of heaven, like here, by reconnecting with that child self that's so enmeshed and comforted in nature. And so I guess it's, you know, like my heaven in terms of working beyond my traumatic childhood and finding peace in the present is in nature. It's in the land. And so that's sort of the deeper meaning of Pure Land for me.
We could easily end here, but there's more to the story. Annette was inspired to found a nonprofit called the Healing Lands Project to help kids affected by trauma and PTSD.
As I was writing this book and having to not only dig into the childhood trauma that Tomomi and Randy experienced, but also my own childhood trauma, there was so much pain that was coming up. And I sometimes would think, why am I writing this book? I wrote the book because I want to help people. I want to raise awareness about the issues around family violence and how looking into family violence and talking about it and dealing with the impacts, whether in the past or the present, is the way to create a more functional society as well as happier individuals. And so in addition to the book, I started a nonprofit so that people who read Pure Land maybe might also be inspired to help support this nonprofit, which is to help children that are experiencing family violence now. And the kinds of things that I experienced and Randy experienced and Tomomi also experienced to a lesser degree in terms of neglect, but not violence. Kids who are suffering now, I want them to be able to get out into nature, into wild places, and to find the healing that I did and the comfort that I did when I was a kid through Mother Earth. You know, if your own mother isn't taking care of you, there's the earth. The Healing Lands Project raises funds to take child victims of domestic violence on river trips. And the unique thing about this is it's not just a fun river trip. The counselors and the social workers that have been working with the kids go on the trip. So therapy happens in the field. The therapists are able to actually do things with the children in a much more comforting and supportive environment than what they would normally have, like in a clinical setting. And this nonprofit is a partnership between myself and the profits of my book. Part of the profits go to Healing Lands Project. And my other partners are Grand Canyon Youth, which is an educational outfitter here in Flagstaff, and Northern Arizona University's Family Violence Institute is the third partner. And the Family Violence Institute specifically takes kids that have experienced what's called intimate partner homicide, which is one parent kills the other. And that's the most extreme kind of family violence. So these kids need more help than anybody. And We are going to be doing our first river trip for the Healing Lands Project this June. We hope to take 10 kids on the river trip, the Upper San Juan River in Utah. Depending on how much money we can raise, that will determine how many kids we can take on the trip, but their counselors are going to be going. And so I'm super excited about being able to do this trip and to be able to take these kids into a wilderness setting. And for many of them, it'll be the first wilderness trip they've ever had in their lives.
It's so wonderful to be able to create that connection and some of that healing earlier in life.
Right. So this will hopefully establish a relationship with nature that they can always come back to. And so as part of the nonprofit program, one of our future goals is to create, a support group where we take the kids on hikes every week after the river trip, that we continue to facilitate outdoor experiences for them. But I'm hoping that they're able to see that they've got a place to find healing in the natural world, and that they'll be able to come back to that as a child and also as an adult.
And will you plan on attending the trip too?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm definitely. I'm doing training right now to be a mentor, going through the program training so that I'm properly prepared, and I will definitely be on the trip.
Mm. That's wonderful. I think it's so great that you took this story that could have been just all darkness and added a lot of layers of light to it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I guess, it was horrific what happened to Tomomi, and I wish she wasn't murdered. I wish, I didn't write a book about how she was murdered, but that's not what happened. But there was a lot of light in her life. Like, she was such a positive person up until the very end. And I was really inspired by her, and I found healing in my connection with her, and she helped to remind me about my connection to nature. And so there's a lot of positive light that comes out of the book and the nonprofit. Out of this pain comes something really positive, and that was what I wanted out of this project.
Something that I couldn't squeeze into this episode was the observation that the American public, myself included, sometimes has a dissociative relationship with the trauma we've inflicted on our land and its people. We alluded to it at the beginning of the episode, but it's worth reflecting on ways we can unbury our history in our everyday. Learn more about the Healing Lands Project at iampureland.com. and the book at purelandbook.com. I'll make sure to link through on our episode landing page and the show notes. The Healing Lands Project is raising money to take those kids on that river rafting trip. Buying the book will help kids get out there, as will donating. Big thank you to Annette for reaching out. It's a dream come true to interview the author of a book that you just devoured. Thank you to Subaru for their sponsorship of this episode. Next week, you'll get to hear my version of a book club in collaboration with Charlotte Austin of Adventure Grapes. We'll discuss Margot Talbot's memoir about climbing, addiction, and depression, all that glitters. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Even better, share it with a friend. And if you enjoy She Explores, you'll probably enjoy our sister show, Women on the Road. It's all about life on the road from the feminine perspective, and it's hosted by Laura Hughes. Music is Shadow Play by Ryan Teague and Lee Rosever. Music for Ads is Swelling via the Free Music Archive. Until next week.